I'm Adam from the Digital Suit Podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeek.com, and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the 8th Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 246 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where all we wanted to do was find a quiet spot somewhere, maybe a buddy's basement, listen to some Black Sabbath albums, play a little D&D, and next thing you know, some wacko in a crazy purple suit and a woman I can only imagine as his granddaughter, or something, are crashing the place, wrecking the artwork, generally killing the whole vibe. Serious bummer, man.
Dude.
I am your host, Haley Malley, and with me in the GPR studios this week, we have Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
As my will, so mote it be.
So mote it be. And Jay Witten. How are you today, Jay?
Have you ever listened to the Doctor Who theme backwards? It doesn't really do anything. It's just weird as hell.
And we are joined this week by a special guest who is no stranger to Whovians. Thanks to a minor assist by that Eighth Doctor guy, he was responsible for the development of the earthquake detection system in 2009, saving millions of lives. You know him as Gareth, but we refer to him here as Jeremy Raddick. Welcome to the GPR studios.
Azal Imohay, Azal. Thank you for having me.
The dialogue in this episode is a gift that just keeps giving. Well, this week, we are gazing into our cauldron, throwing a few pinches of colored flash powder and some dried sage in for effect, and summoning up a Pertwee, Delgado, and Katie Manning classic in the physical manifestation of the demons. It's a little bit of everything that fans could possibly hope for from the eighth season. So you got a little bit of the supernatural, but that doesn't get discussed in Doctor Who, so it's very quickly turned into something that's a little extraterrestrial, with a healthy serving of complete lack of reason along the way. So this is a 70s sci-fi at its absolute best, people. You gotta believe me on this. I don't even know where to start because... I always know where to start on this one. And that's by pointing a forked hand at Haley and saying, what did you think of this, first-time viewer?
I feel like the entire purpose of this story was to see how much they could get Delgado to look like the devil, right down to giving him a three-pointed candelabra to point at people.
Yeah. Holding him off. There's so many gifts in this. Delgado was just, this is one of his cheese balliest best. He must have reveled in doing this story.
Yeah, I hear that he loved like the red cloak that he wore, you know, and like that was like one of his favorite things. Like if he could have kept that, he would have.
It was pretty fantastic. Magnificent.
Yeah, I was trying to pick out which curtain pattern that actually came from because it had like the perfect little, you know, little patterns on it. Oh, and yeah. the collar with all of the symbology on it.
I think Scarlett O'Hara used that to make a dress at some point.
Probably.
I think that was in my parents' rec room in 1978, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Right next, it covered the shuffleboard near the wet bar. That's what it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but in all Haley, how did you feel? Because I mean, I know you get you tend to feel the slog when you get to longer, you know, multi-episode stories. This one was 5 instead of 6, which we've had for a little while.
Yeah, that was fine. I didn't feel like a slog at any point, but this one was a little more fantastical than some of the others can be. Mm. So I feel like that lets you sustain the story a little better.
Okay, all right. Jay, what was your take looking back on this one in retrospect? Oh God,
I've always loved this one. This one's always been one of my favorite Pertwee episodes or stories. It's so completely out there. It's unlike most anything that we've gotten, at least up to this point. This is one of the more fantastical stories that we get until we get to like the Seventh Doctor. So it is a fun change of pace. It is one of those that just. It sticks with you. It sticks in your memory. You'll always remember, you know, the master throwing the devil horns and all of the crazy stuff. It just, I remember the first time I watched it though, and the first time you see Azal wondering, when did I start watching Clash of the Titans? Like,
very true. Yeah, very true. I will say though, I mean, in defense of this particular story and the way that they tried to temper we had a couple people when they heard that we were going to getting to this point in the classic rewatch, and they said, "Oh, you know, you got to bear in mind that this was pretty racy for 1971. Mm. I mean, there were some overt occult references in here, down to pentagrams and everything associated with it, chicken sacrifices and everything. I mean, this was ballsy, and it didn't really flinch away from it. Granted, it tried to explain it all away, saying, oh, well, it's 100,000 years, this was the origin of the devil on Earth, was actually Azal the whole time, which was a great concept.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. if you want to play around with that, oh, well, and they even go through the various mythologies and saying, oh, I wonder why they all happen to look slightly the same. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, this is a great little sci-fi theory, which we've played with multiple times in Doctor Who and other universes. But I think as far as from a technical aspect, think about like some of the camera angles that were used and some of the tricks that were used were actually pretty progressive as well. A lot of shots where during a lot of the Benton and Yates fight sequences, of which I don't think I've ever seen these two guys slug it out as much as they have in these 5 episodes. It was glorious. John Levine thumping people in his corduroy pants. But there were things like, you know, when a fight sequence would end, when somebody was knocked to the ground, you'd have the camera on the grass looking upward past, you know, the person laid out prone towards the person who knocked him down. I mean, these were all kind of interesting high action angles, as well as the effects, like when everybody's stumbling out of the church, one of the many times everybody comes stumbling out of the church, instead of just doing the shaky cam, they're doing the shaky cam and they're playing with the zoom and focus at the same time as they're doing overexposure on the lens to sort of give mm-hmm. it this kind of whitewash effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen all the little pieces used before, but this is one of the times that really stands out in memory that they combined it all to just make it as otherworldly as possible. So I think with the exception of maybe Azal's green screen giantness, that was probably the only effect, I think, that really said, okay, you're showing your age on this one. Everything else worked really well.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. That was the only time that I was really like, wow, that's not good. But that really, that's about the only time that it happened was that, the blue screen. And that's all of what, like 10 seconds out of 5 episodes?
Yeah.
I think they got a pretty good margin there.
I mean, that's as good as, I don't know if you watched Hercules or Xena in the 90s, like that's as good as their effects were.
Precisely.
Yeah, and if you're getting mad at 1970s Barry Letts era Doctor Who for bad CSO, you're going to be mad a lot of the time. Because, you know, he was an early adopter of the green screen CSO technology. There are times when he used it, you're like, why are you doing a green screen kitchen? You should have a budget for that. But, you know, there are times when it doesn't work, and there are times when it's clearly too ambitious. But, you know, you can't fault them for, you know, trying these things and trying to make it work and trying to add some scope and scale to a production that can sometimes, you know, not have enough resources to pull this stuff off. And, you know, I always say if you're looking at it and you can't get past some dodgy effects here and there, then I don't know if you're really going to be able to be a classic Who fan. Because they're always present and they're always great. So, you know, I mean, it's it never bothers me. And I think this one has a lot of really great. I mean, Christopher Barry directed it and he had a real skill. I don't think it's his best story, but it's got some of his best work in it.
Mm.
You know, he was a really inventive guy. So I like that aspect of it for sure.
Definitely agree. Yeah. I mean, from there's a lot of attention to detail on the set itself. Whether it's the done in the soundstage or the things that were on location in the where were they Alburn, where they actually shot most of this, including the pub, which, you know, renaming it to the Devil's Horn. Ah, yeah. they were really like paint an inch thick on a lot of these things. But I mean, as far as the sets, the costumes, obviously, and the props, a lot of the props that were utilized were really, really attentive to the detail. Like that weird square on the floor within the dungeon basement there that no one could step on and things, all the intricacy in that. I think the only thing that, as far as any of those artistic developments, the only thing that really kind of left me a little cold was just Bach. He was just really... a leotard, and
Bach is adorable. Come on,
he is.
He's great. Every time he hops into the, you know, that little, you know, I think it was a guy named Stanley Mason. I want to say, anyways, he's playing it for all he's worth. I love Bach. I mean, I'm not scared of Bach, but I think he's, you know, he's just sort of one of, in a long line, like from the Yeti to Bach to Alpha Centauri, just sort of unfortunately imaginative but endearingly, you know, not quite working Doctor Who monster. You know, it's like sometimes you just kind of go, yeah, that's a guy in a leotard with the paper mache wings and chap with the wings there. You know, I mean, that's who he is. I love that about Bach.
Days ago, I think I was somewhere through doing the rewatch, and I'm like maybe somewhere in the midst of episode 3 or 4. Julie walks past the screen because she didn't have the time to watch it, and she's like, "Oh, what's going on here?" And I said, "Oh, it's a gargoyle. It's been manifested, come to life by the master, big occult thing." And she goes, "Huh? So it's like the Weeping Angel's origin story?"
Oh, I thought the same thing.
Oh.
No, that guy's gonna lose his wings and then wander onto a Power Ranger set.
Yeah. Yeah.
There were some things in here that I think are good to know. I mean, we always like to talk about whether or not these things bear the need for rewatch, like, or whether you want to add them to the must watch, you know, lists for people that are sort of, you know, working their way through what would you consider to be the quintessential first Doctor, second Doctor, third Doctor, and so forth. We'll definitely get to that. But I think some things that for me make this such a must when I'm getting through, because I love season 8 in its entirety. I love the schmaltziness of it, but at the same time, there's so many little nuggets. So we've got things like Tom Osgood.
Yes.
As your scientific, or as your, well, I guess, electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Moffat has said that he desperately wanted to explicitly say that Tom was Osgood's father, but he didn't want to, at the time, confuse viewers and make them have to go dig through the obscura. So, well done to him, because he's given up that premise not long after. I think he learned his lesson and said, oh, screw it, I'm going to throw all the Easter eggs in. They're eating them up. They're eating them up. But they never really made it canon, but I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, I think somewhere in the comics they sort of made an uncle reference or something, I think.
I think you're right. I don't know 100%, but I think you're right. I mean, it's just hanging out there. I mean, I don't know if the actor who played him, Alec Linstead, is still alive, but if he is, he and Ingrid Oliver will be doing a big finish, I'm sure, at some point. The funny thing about that character is he and John Pertwee did not get along at all.
Oh.
The actor and I don't know why, but they didn't get along. And you can totally see it in Pertwee's just like complete impatience with everything he does. You know, I mean, there's nothing that he does that the third Doctor is like, good work, Osgood. He's always just like, ugh. This freaking guy again, you know. I mean, it's pretty obvious that Pertwee's just like, I'm done with this, you know. So
yeah. But I think it works well for the scenes too.
Yeah, and he looks like my dad, so that's always a weird thing.
Yeah. Down to the thick black rimmed glasses and all.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
As far as Joe's involvement on this one, How do we feel? I mean, this was, we always like to watch Katie Manning's work, especially through this particular season, and see how different writers will utilize her more or less, from damsel to catalyst, you know, or anywhere within that spectrum. Where do we feel that she kind of fell in this particular story? I mean, granted, I'm gonna leave the ending off of this, because that kind of gets us to our, you know, oh crap, we got to wrap this up in a page and a half. Quick, give me a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Let's kill him with love.
don't get me started.
This may have been one of the origin points of win the battle with love. Maybe. But all in all, I mean, as far as Joe Grant's her role within this story proper, how do we feel about this?
She demonstrated the importance of wearing a seatbelt.
Yes, Bessie, not exactly compliant.
Yeah.
Bessie's a death trap, really. There's no seatbelts, there's no roof, there's no doors.
Yeah, the early stages of autonomous vehicles, really dodgy.
Yeah.
Volvo had nothing to do with this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you started asking the question, and my first thought was honestly, wait, Joe was in the rest of it, not just the end?
Yeah.
I don't think it's a great, I mean, like, it's, you know what the thing of it is? And this is my problem with season 8 Joe, which is I love Joe, but I think it took them a while to really figure out. Like, I think they course corrected so huge after Liz Shaw. They were like, oh, she was way too competent. That did not work for us at all. We're gonna have to have someone more naive, more childlike. I don't think that was necessarily wrong, but I think they overcompensated. And I think also when Katie was cast, because, you know, anyone who's ever met Miss Manning knows she has sort of that sort of fun, scatty kind of personality.
Mm-hmm.
I think they really fell in love with her as an actor, and they started making Joe more towards that. And so part of the problem I have sometimes with season 8 is that, like, no one's nice to her in season 8. Like, in this, when I watched it this time, I'm like, the Doctor is a jerk to her for 75% of the story. Like, there's that great scene where the Doctor's on a conversation with the Brigadier, and the Brigadier's outside the heat shield and he can't get in, and the Doctor's really frustrated, and he starts, like, you know, doing his typical laying into the Lethbridge steward and making fun of him and all that sort of stuff. And then he hangs up the phone, and Joe does, like, the most mild, tiny little rebuke, you know, to be like, yeah, I get you, Doctor, that Brigadier. And the Brigadier's like, well, you know, Joe, he is your superior officer, and you should show him over. So, like, just lays into him. And Mike Yates, like, and Benton kind of grin like, ah, silly Joe. And I'm like, guys, like, you know, like, sometimes it was a little bit like, can we just, you know, take it a bit easy? You know, she is scatterbrained, but, you know, I wish sometimes she showed a little bit less, like, total, like, you know, she's got the map upside down and she doesn't know where she's going. She's a secret agent, you know, I mean, she is the most least qualified secret agent in this one you've ever seen. She can't read a map. That should be basic stuff. And I think in later years, in 9 and 10, I think Katie Manning, and to some degree the production team, really knew how she could play against that, so that when the Doctor was still a little waspish with her, she kind of gave him a look like, you and I both know that you're just being a bit of a jerk right now. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In the same way, like, I don't think she still got the same kind of lines, but she was able to kind of play off that a little bit better.
Yeah.
And in this, you know, this one, the Damons particularly, until the end, I'm kind of like, man, you know, Joe doesn't seem to know. And, like, she's doing all this stuff that's great. There's the Doctor when the Doctor gets, you know, frozen, the village Doctor was totally like, yeah, he's dead, bury him. And she's like, no, keep trying, he's different. You know, I'm like, she's totally does great stuff to save the day, but I kind of hate the way that everybody's, like, you know, this close to telling her to put the kettle on, you know, throughout the series. That always bugs me with season 8 Joe. But other than that, I think there's a lot of stuff she does in here that's really kind of cool and you know, smart and definitely intrepid.
Yeah, well, thanks to the conveniently placed ladders outside of bedroom windows.
That's true.
I mean, as long as that's there, you know.
Yeah.
Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, well, she was blind. You know, Katie Manning's, like, got terrible vision, so Christopher Barry put that there so that she wouldn't fall off the roof.
Yeah. Oh, it's got your best interest at heart.
Yeah, that's true.
It's I'm kind of surprised because they had been, Barry Letts and company had been trying to sort of work Yates as the just under the surface romantic protector, the knight in shining armor for Joe, and this episode this story sort of forgot that at times. When they had a scene, just the two of them, and had their exchanges, there was a bit of that, just that kind of connection. But I think that was just because the two actors got on so well. But at any point where it was actually written into the script that, as you said, he and Benton exchange a look or something of that sort, and it undermined it a bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But as far as the, it just brings me back to, I want to say, if I ever see a cosplayer, anyone who wants to tap in to this story, I don't want to see the Delgado master in the red robes. I don't even want to see Bach. I don't even want to see people as Azal. I want to see Olive Hawthorne. I want someone to stand there with the Ankh pendant on and the handbag with a crystal ball in it there to cold clock people. And someone has to follow her around with a hurricane fan all the time. Because I love this woman. I love her to death. And the fact that she's vindicated repeatedly through the story. No one ever puts her down for her beliefs. Even people that are like men of the cloth or what have you, they all say, well, that's her thing and she's very committed to it. And I thought that was a fascinating way of portraying a character who very easily could have been represented as the village kook. But it never really crossed that line. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I don't know why, what it was that changed, or the thing that I found interesting was that it was, like we said earlier, there was a lot of stuff in this episode that would have been, absolutely taboo at the time. Mm. So having just a witch at all, even though she was a white witch, which, I mean, how many people actually take the time to delve into that? They just hear witch and instantly it's like, oh god, nope, can't touch that. But to actually get into the semantics of it and determine that it's different, just even that much, I was amazed with.
Yeah. There's a lot of background research. They were talking about the use of iron, the validity of incantations and calling upon, well, we cast it under psionic energy, but the whole fact that that's normally part of summonings and all that sort of aspect of the occult. There's a lot of good backstory to this.
Yeah, it was definitely something Barry Letts was really, really into. For the benefit of listeners, it's written by a guy named Guy Leopold, who doesn't exist. It was really written by Barry Letts and Robert Sloman, who were frequent writing partners, but they used a pseudonym. And they were really into this stuff. And Damaris Hayman, who plays Miss Hawthorne, was deeply into the occult. And a funny trivia thing is that when Christopher Barry wanted her to be the village kook, wanted to play her much more silly. And Miss Hayman was kind of offended by that and thought, no. She says, when she read the script, basically her point was, if we play her as the village kook, it doesn't make any sense because everything she prophesizes comes to pass. Yeah. She has everything she says is right. And so she actually wound up taking it all the way to Barry Letts, who agreed with her. And that's why she's played in the way that she is and treated the way that she is throughout the story, because, all these people involved in the show are, if not believers in it as the actress was, but if you're Barry Letts, I think definitely fascinated by it. I mean, he was a Buddhist, so, he wasn't, I think, into black magic in that sense, but he, I think the occult fascinated him. And so, that's sort of the funny thing about all of the Doctor's protestations throughout, that it's science and a different form of science. Mm-hmm. That's great, and that's in there, and that's awesome. But one of the things that's really interesting about the Daemons is, even though he says all that, there's no explanation for how she calms the winds down and gets that guy to not bean her in the back of the head with a rock. There's no explanations for her foresight. And the only thing that you walk away with is that she's got some sort of connection to something.
Right.
And so in a way, it does say, yes, it's all a science. Maybe it's all a science we don't understand, but it doesn't provide answers for her. And so she becomes the character that maybe magic is real, and that's sort of the fun way to do it in that, think about her. I think she's awesome throughout. Like, she's kind of flirty with Benton, which is great too. You know, kinda? She's kind of like young man and making him tea, and you know, I mean, it's great. That's a fantastic. She's just so lovely to watch.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Anything that makes John Levine kind of rock back on his heels a little bit is always an entertaining moment.
I also had a thought too about Benton in this that I'd never thought in my life, but. And this, when he meets her, he says, I'm Sergeant Benton. Maybe, what if his name is Sergeant Benton?
Major. And then there was obviously one of the many, many times where we've had the mention of Atlantis. Remember Atlantis. Well, we've played around with the Atlantis demise story a couple times within the Hooniverse. This is, I think, the first chronologically, but they played with it a few times over. I don't know. I mean, as far as Azal goes, I think out of everything through this story, I think Azal was probably the weak point because there were no real demonstrations of how authoritative, how powerful he really was. If there was something other than just making the winds and the lights and the ground shake and something where he could explicitly point to the fact that I caused this, this, and this. Remember Atlantis was probably the closest they came to saying, look, all right, I've wiped you out once before. Don't fail me again because you know what I do with failures. So I think that, I don't know, am I alone in thinking that that was kind of, I was more concerned about the master and his plans and his mind control over the entire village and having his whole coven at his beck and call. And then when Azal finally manifests himself or he finally gets summoned, like, okay, Goatman on stilts, got a big booming voice. Really would have been entertaining if it was Brian Blessed. Picture that one for a second.
Yeah. Stephen Thorne ain't that far away from Brian Blessed. He's pretty close.
But I wanted more of a danger. You know, this was something where if left unchecked could have meant the eradication of humanity as we know it, because he had steered the evolution of mankind, you know, from Homo sapiens over the Neanderthals and so forth, as the doctor explained. So I guess I just wanted something a little bit more to bite into to say, no, this needs to be stopped.
Yeah.
I can definitely agree with that. I mean, it was just kind of like you knew that the master couldn't get his power because it was the master, and him getting anything he wants is dangerous. But beyond that, it was like, well, so what? Okay.
Wasn't there also a reference to, as the doctor's summoning him when he finally, the second time around, you know, after Azal says, I will come to you one more time. it's like the ghost of Christmas past. You will be visited by...
I thought the same thing.
Because we only have the effects budget for one more visit. But when the master's summoning him, he says, I think he refers to the nameless one somewhere in his incantations, as if he's referring to someone even more powerful. And my brain stuck on that, and I forgot about it. Years go by, and then I rewatch it. And I thought, oh yeah, you don't just put something like that in there. And then I thought, oh. Do we need to tie this into the Satan pit or something? I go, oh, where can I possibly link this to? You know,
yeah. No, it's I'll tell you, like, my overall feeling on the Daemons is like I don't like when I look at it objectively. I don't quite know why I love it so much because it has two central big problems, right? And structurally, the first is that the Doctor knows exactly what's going on and who's responsible and who's behind it about 8 minutes into the thing, right? Mm-hmm. He sees the documentary and he's like, Joe, we got to get up there. And then basically the next four episodes become how do we put stuff in his way to keep him from just solving this quickly? Mm-hmm. And it also leads to that. It's a cool thing, but it's also kind of like inartfully done where they all get in the pub and the Doctor gets a slideshow out. Like, when you're making great television, like, your dramatic moment should not hinge on a slideshow, right? Like, that's just not, that's script writing 101. It's like, and then in the middle, they watch slides. You know, I mean, that's not a moment where you necessarily, like, are going to make people lean forward in their seats, right?
If you don't realize
unless you do it in a Buffy episode, then it's fantastic.
That's true.
You do realize that this is the tipping point that's going to cause Elon Musk to become a super villain. He's one slideshow away from global domination.
It's true. It's like a PowerPoint presentation shouldn't be the climax of the James Bond movie, right? You know, and it's just, you know, he then explains everything to everyone, and then they have to solve it. And then I've got my own problems with how it gets solved, which we'll get to. But that to me is like, there's a lot of sort of stuff happens, like the Doctor gets frozen, and then, you know, he has the great, like, Barry lets Terrence Dick sleep talking where Joe's asleep, knocked out, and she's feverishly saying, like, the ancient one. And, you know, there's all these, like, obstacles that get put in the way to keep him from just saying what's going on, who's responsible, and how to stop it until they're ready for it. So to me, like, that's a bit of a failure of the script, that he should be more like, I know something's happening, but I don't know what it is, and there's more of an investigation. And I think that might have solved your problem, Kieran. Like, if the Doctor has to uncover the power levels of Azal and understand what they are and go, oh my God, this guy's, like, if he's shocked by the realization that human history has been molded by this guy, but instead he just kind of goes, oh yeah, all that stuff you thought you accomplished on your own, that was all Azal. And I knew this, like, for a long time, and it's, you know, and it's just kind of casually letting that out, and that's kind of a big deal, you know. And so that's the thing to me that I always kind of get hung up on the Daemon. So for me, I'm like, you know, structurally from a script point of view, there are times when I'm like, it's not really structured in a way to bring excitement, but there's something about, like, everybody's having a great time. It's clear they're all hanging out at the pub after they finish shooting, and, you know, and, like, you've got Mike in his tweedy tweeds and Benton in his red fancy, you know, skin tight corduroys, and Delgado's got the doing black magic, which we all wanted him to do from the beginning anyways. And, you know, and it's just kind of so warm and wonderful in that sense that it kind of papers over the fact that Azal's not really much of a villain, and, you know, and the threat is kind of weird, and you don't really understand if the villagers are mind controlled or if they're greedy, or, and that kind of shifts, and
or just, you know, immensely stupid.
Yeah, I mean, that scene where the Master, I guess, charms them is the weirdest scene. Mm. One of the weirdest Master scenes ever, because he starts off by revealing embarrassing secrets. Uh-huh. Then by telling them everything they want will be.
Oh, yeah, is your wife still out of town? And
yeah! He's just like,
what are you doing?
Your wife's still, yeah, I know. And, like, and then he's like, then he kills a guy, right, in the middle of it, their leader, right? And then he just is like, now go away. And I don't understand. And then the next thing you see them, they're all, like, totally okay with killing the Doctor and burning him at the stake. It's a weird, like, why are you doing this?
Also, that is not at all enough wood to burn somebody to death with. They had, like, one bundle of dry straw.
Yeah. At most, he's going to wind up with third-degree burns on his legs.
Well, as we
it's
going to
cinch his leg hairs.
No, it's going to kill him through smoke inhalation. That's what it is.
Witches are made of wood.
That velvet suit would go up like like a just a jippy log. It would just
be popping. They're counting on the hair product catching. That's what it is.
That's true.
So I think all in all, I have to agree. There's so many aspects of this that just make it enjoyable. This is popcorn. Who? This is just just forget it. Put disbelief, large hook. Go enjoy this one, because you're not going to remember 90% of it. Three stories later, it's just going to become, oh, that was the one with the Delgado Ronnie James Dio album cover and the gargoyle. The rest of it I don't really remember. But and the main
can we spare a moment for Professor whatever his name is in the beginning, who has, first of all, no desire as a scientist to explain what he's doing, no idea how television works. That's my favorite too. He's telling the guy, like, he should have done his homework and stuff like that. And it's like, well, no, idiot. He's trying to, you know, like, show it. But, like, why are you doing this? I don't understand.
Please explain for the camera. I don't want to explain all these simpletons. Can you imagine Professor Brian Cox? He's at a speaking lecture and someone's asking him these questions to try and say, I want to explain to my 12-year-old, you know, the wonders of astrophysics. It's beyond you. Shut up. Move on. Next thing.
I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
Yeah. He's a professor. The whole point of his title is to explain things. Yes, and he's like, I have no time for this. It's insulting. You know, I love him. He's so, like, when he dies, you're like, he kind of deserved that a little bit. Oh, but he was just obnoxious.
Damn it, he pulled the Dick Professor card. Why did he do that? I don't know. So all right. So this is where we get to. We have to talk about our conclusion. So Azal starts to get extremely angry. Who's going to inherit my power? You get the power? No, you get the power. I don't want the power. Okay, well, I'll take the power. No, you don't get the power either. Nobody gets the power. I'm going to kill all of you. And Joe Grant jumps forward and says, I love everybody. And Azal dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
Help me understand what the heck just happened.
Science.
That's true, Kier. It's science. Don't argue with me. It's science. Yeah.
Something about reversing the polarity of psychokinetic energy stuff. Yep.
Okay. So there really is nothing you could slap over this to say, well, in all fairness.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, you know, like, to be honest, it's a this is one of the reasons why it's really important to know Barry Letts wrote it, because Terrence Dix, master of plotting, there is no way on God's green earth that if somebody else had dripped this in, he wouldn't have been like, I'm going to rewrite this and make this make sense. It's because it's his boss who's mm-hmm. written it, and he's and his best friend, and he's kind of like, all right, we're going to let this go. It's silly, you know, but we're, and you know, it's the weirdest. It's such an insane, he's like a Star Trek computer, you know, it's like, what is this thing called kissing? And then it blows up. It's a very weird, it's very strange. First of all, Azal's like a living being, like he's alive. Why does he not understand the concept of love? Secondly, why does that surprise him that it would happen? Is this the
100,000 years observing the species? Yeah.
Yeah. And nobody's ever sacrificed.
Yeah, he's the worst scientist ever. He's like a climate change denying scientist. He's the worst. He just doesn't understand science or people. So it's a weird. The thing that makes it great is at the end, everybody gets and dances around the maypole, and it's nice and warm and lovely. Because if it ended with the blowing up, and then the doctor turned to like the master and went, well, that's that, I guess. I mean, you would be going, what the hell was that? You
know? So back to the pub, freeze frame, credits.
Yeah, that would have been great, actually.
The thing that I found interesting, though, like we mentioned Bond before, but the helicopter blowing up, apparently there was a lot of people convinced that they actually blew up a helicopter. They took unused footage from one of the Bond films and put that in there.
That's awesome.
But people were so like, it looked so good on screen that people were like, oh my God, they blew up the helicopter. And then the church blowing up at the end mm-hmm. was obviously it was a miniature, but on screen, it looked convincing enough that the BBC was actually getting hate mail for blowing up a church.
I believe it. Those effects, the pyrotechnic effects, were solid. Yeah. Even down to some of the hokier stuff, like, you know, trying to throw things through the heat barrier.
Oh, I thought that looked great.
Yeah.
Every time it happened, it was really cool. When the Brigadier takes the rock, or no, when the Doctor takes the rock and throws it, and goes poof right away. It's like, that's awesome. Yeah. It looks so good. Yeah.
I just wanted them to just try one person, just stick their hand in. Ah, probably doesn't work on organic material. Yeah.
Right.
No, not even one. Just rocks.
It would have been Osgood. It would have been Osgood.
I love the fact that the Brig says, we've tested everything on it, Doctor. Rocks, wood, 4-inch plate armor. Okay, so those are the three things you've tried.
That's everything.
Okay.
Yeah. All the things.
Basic elements right there.
Doctor says, have you gone over it?
I would have loved it if he just kept going. Like rocks, wood, 4-inch armor, hats. A monkey, you know, a small child,
a jar of marmalade. You
know, a jar of marmalade. It would have been great just to see how silly Nicholas Courtney could get. More heat. We threw fire at it. It just became more fire.
And of course, we get obviously the one of the best deliveries of the 5 rounds rapid line that the Brig could have possibly delivered. The Brig, rocky start in the first couple episodes, didn't really understand why he was there, and suddenly gets into his dress nines, goes off to a party, then they wake him in bed. Very unusual time for Nicholas Courtney. This is wait, you want me to put this thing on, and then the next time I'm off for an entire story, I come back in 3 weeks, and you want me to climb into bed? What this script?
You know, the best thing is it was supposed to like have like a female hand like picking up the phone and passing it to him, like the Brig had been out, like, you know, because you know Mike says like he left the, you know, the ball. No one knows where he went. So the implication was that the Brig like found some lady and he was like, yeah, let's get down to business. And then they had to track him down somewhere. I think that would have been great.
It would have. It would have. It would have fit the persona perfectly. All right. Well, this is where we get to talk about whether or not we feel that this is one that is on a scale of not only rewatchability but reference to people that are trying to build their classic Whovian repertoire. Haley, since you're starting to piece this together from the ground up, would you consider this one that that is a really quintessential representation of what you've seen from Pertwee so far? Or is this one that you think is going to be easily forgettable or somewhere in between?
I don't know that there's anything really quintessential about this episode, but it's a lot of fun. So I think I would include it in any Pertwee starter pack I was giving a Nuvian.
There you go. Okay. Jay, what's your take on it?
I'd totally recommend this. It is one of the funnest episodes of Pertwee's era, if not all of Classic Who. So it... I definitely wouldn't start them off with the classic era with this one.
No.
But once they get a feel for what the classic era is, absolutely jump in this one with both feet. Have fun with it. Don't expect to learn too much, but just have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeremy, what's your overall opinion?
Yeah, I think I'm going to be the little bit of the naysayer. I mean, like, I agree with everything you said. It's so fun and so warm, and it's kind of like this perfect little encapsulation of this era, right? It's everything about it is great. It's got, you know, the squatties and the master and Joe and the doctor, and it just feels like, you know, if you ask people who watched this era of Doctor Who, you know, what was it like? They would be thinking of this story, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I feel like it's like such a worthwhile quintessential, you know, piece of this era, because kind of the elements of atmosphere of the era come together perfectly here. Having said that, I will also say that if someone said to me, like, what's the best John Pertwee story? Mm. This would not get in anywhere close to the top 10, because I think, you know, Inferno, Green Death, I think there's a bunch of more ambitious and engaging and well-structured and executed stories. Mm. But for pure, like, it ends with them all, like the Brigadier and Mike going having a drink at the pub and everybody else dancing around the maypole. It's like the most warm kind of nostalgic feeling of Doctor Who. So I would tell people, don't watch it if you want to know what the best John Pertwee story is. But if you want to know what the warmest one is and the sort of most charming one is, this is a really good contender for that.
I have to agree. This is, I think I agree with Haley. It has to be somewhere in that sort of starter set, but somewhere towards the end, so people can see how far it can be pushed, or what some of the contributions to the overall pantheon are from the principal characters. Even if you're just talking just within season 8, but then when you want to say, all right, but they can really have a lot of fun with it too. So now that you've been exposed to some of these headier ideas or some of the things with places where they sort of push things forward for the show proper, especially if they're watching it in some sort of linear fashion, then you stick this in and say, okay, and then this is what happens when they kind of let their hair down a bit. Listeners, do what you choose with this, but I think we would all kind of say that this deserves the watch. If you've listened now 45 minutes into this conversation, you've probably done the rewatch, so good on you, mate. But I got something I want to do with everybody, if you want to indulge me for a second here. So, Jeremy, since we knew we were going to have you on tonight, I figured what more could we do than make it extremely awkward for you and put you in the hot seat for some questions that have to do with a lot of the things that we've been discussing quite a bit over recent weeks. Okay.
Okay.
So, obviously, we're sort of interspersing now that we're in this break period, which is going to last until Christmas and then take a big, long-ass break again until next Christmas. And we're going to have a lot of things to talk about in between. We've been doing our classic rewatches. And then we've been doing some sort of reflection on how we've come in New Who to date. So,
right.
Some questions to throw at you that have to sort of jump around a little bit. We just come across our classic rewatch of this episode. How, I know that you are a dyed-in-the-wool, been there since the early stages Whovian, and you've carried it from the classics through the modern run.
Yeah.
How attached would you say are you to the classics as you're watching modern Who? In incorporating that into your personal headcanon and thinking, that doesn't jive with what I remember from such and such and such.
You know, I became a fan in the wilderness years, right? Which is a really interesting time to be a fan. And, you know, I mean, there was no New Who. And Nuhu has got, I'm assuming, some sort of Bible, and it has some sort of way to keep it all straight. Terrence Dix famously said continuity was what they could remember when they were doing the classic series. And so there's all sorts of contradictions that you have to make do with when you watch the classic series. And Atlantis, you brought it up today, right? Like, Underwater Menace has Atlantis. The Time Monster has Atlantis. This mentions Atlantis. I think there's like four different separate stories of what Atlantis was and how it sank in Doctor Who. And so I don't really try to merge on the stuff that's important. Then, yeah, there has to be some continuity. But I also really feel strongly that one of the most beautiful things that ever happened in the history of the classic series was when William Hartnell was leaving, they made the choice not to go with a guy in a William Hartnell wig or a young William Hartnell or an actor who tried to be William Hartnell. They said, oh, we're just going to have him be a totally different person, behaving a totally different way, but it's the same guy. And they didn't explain it, and they didn't care, right? It was just so inventive. They didn't let continuity – they weren't slaves to the continuity. They weren't slaves to the canon. And so I much more appreciate people who can – and in the new series – writers who can not be slaves to the canon of the past, but find interesting ways to integrate them. And I don't need it to line up perfectly. I really don't. It just has to be intriguing, and it has to lead to a better story. Because I think – and I mean, like, the other job that I have is reviewing comics. And sometimes comics are stifled by a slavish adherence to what came before. And it stopped – Well, it's terrible. I know. It's shocking, right?
I can't.
It's true.
Good thing I don't read them.
It's true. Yeah. Good for you. They're garbage. They rot your brain. But no, I think that continuity is only helpful if it serves imagination. And if it doesn't, then it's not helpful. It's just rules, right? And I don't think there should be rules, certainly not in Doctor Who. So it's not that important to me, but I like it when it's done well.
Okay.
That's my waffly sort of answer.
Yeah, that's okay. Very Moffat-ish.
Yeah.
Hedging your bets.
I suppose it's true.
All right, so you're obviously a fan of the classic series. Who would you say is your classic companion then?
Do you mean like who I think is the best or who's my favorite?
Who is your favorite?
Yeah.
Let's do both.
My favorite is Jamie McCrimmon.
Okay.
That's my favorite. He is, to my mind, just absolutely the best. He's stalwart. He's brave. He's not smart, but he doesn't have to be. And he has – no, but like seriously, that's an important thing. Like I think Jamie's very smart in a way, but also, you know, it's always basic in its intelligence. And he's, you know, just so devoted to being there for him. And he, as an actor, had the best chemistry. He was the first guy I really felt like he was the Doctor's best friend.
Oh, yeah.
Like that was the Doctor's – and that was the first person that I really felt that way about. Now, who's the best? It's got to be Liz Sladen. You know, she was just wonderful in every scene she was in and, you know, really took the model of what a companion is and ran with it and is sort of put – other than the actors who played the Doctor, probably the most important actor to ever be in the show. So because, you know, the idea of a female companion is largely based on what she and Katie Manning kind of created together between them. But Sladen was just – yeah, she was a sight to behold. So those are my two favorites.
Okay. And what about let's jump forward and say modern Who. And we'll let you determine how to interpret companion.
Right. Well, I always tap sort of Daphne, who I was in the movie with in modern Who, and I love Daphne, so I'll have to say that I have a special place in my heart for Grace Holloway. But if I can't pick Grace because I was in it, I have to say Donna was my favorite for a long time. I thought that she was great, and I thought Catherine Tate was really so just bold and brave in the role and surprised us, you know what I mean? Because we all thought she was just going to be this comedian and she was going to be, you know, the runaway bride, you know, throughout the whole season, and some of us weren't too happy about that. But my, you know, just the growth of that character and the journey she went on was great. If she'd had more time, I probably would say Bill. But I think for some reason, just the journey we got with Donna was so so great and tragic. I wish it had ended a bit differently. I'm not happy with her lack of agency in the end. But there were tons of moments where I thought she was just, you know, that was another one where I like it when they're best friends. I like it when the Doctor and his companion are best friends. That's my favorite relationship. And they clearly were, just like Jamie and the second Doctor were. So, yeah, probably my favorite, Donna.
Okay.
So moving even further forward towards, I guess you'd call it our bleeding edge right now, what were your personal reactions to Jodie Whittaker's casting as our 13th Doctor?
Well, here's the thing. Remembering the myriad amount of episodes and stories that ended with the Doctor saving the universe with his penis.
Yeah.
I just don't see how we're going to move forward with a female Doctor. I mean, what? He clearly needs to have male genitalia in order to be...
Yeah, I mean, how is he even going to operate the TARDIS without a penis?
Exactly, right? There's that slot where I always assumed it was just going in and powering the TARDIS the whole time. You know what? I think she's great. She's a terrific... I mean, Broadchurch... If you've seen her in Broadchurch, how can you have a problem with it? She's magnificent in that show. She's great in Attack the Block. She's a terrific actress who's done great work, very deserving of the part. It's way past time that this happened. And you know what? All of the things about the Doctor that I love, his honesty, his creativity, his, you know, honesty with a small h because he lies all the time, but, you know, his intellectual honesty and his tolerance and his compassion and his creativity. I mean, that's the thing that he doesn't have authority in a classical sense, but he's not even always the smartest guy in the room, but he's the most creative and imaginative person in the room. And so to take that, there's nothing in any of those qualities that couldn't apply to a woman and shouldn't and do apply to women, lots of women. And from a production standpoint, why wouldn't you want to increase your talent pool to the other 50% of the population? You know, there's amazing actresses out there that'll be lots of people's favorite doctors. So I have no problems with it. I wish her all the luck in the world, and I can't wait to see what she does with it. I think it's going to be fascinating. So, that's how I feel.
Obviously, you're really familiar with Broadchurch, and you may have seen some of Chris Chibnall's other work to date, both within Doctor Who and out. Knowing that nature of work, you know, or the kind of dynamic that he's brought to productions like that, what sort of effect do you think that might have on what we're going to see in Series 11?
It's really hard to say. I was encouraged a little bit. I don't know if I was encouraged by it, but I was intrigued when he said that he was flirting with the idea of going away from a submission production style, like the way Doctor Who works now is they have writers and they ask them to provide a script and,
back
you know,
in a writer's
they usually
room.
Give them... Yeah, and he's talking about putting it into a writer's room concept. I think that's going to depend on what the makeup of his writer's room is going to be. I mean, if it's him and, you know, and Mark Gatiss and, you know, and all and Jamie Matheson and all these other people that we've had before, that's going to be very similar. But what's interesting is I think that may engender less contempt, right? Like there's that classic saying, familiarity breeds contempt, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you see that Jamie Matheson, you kind of sit there and go, oh, is his script's coming? Or a Gatiss. Let's take Gatiss as a better example, right? His script's coming in. You kind of feel before you even sit down to watch it, if you're a big fan, like you kind of know what he's going to do. And, you know, Mark Gatiss may still write scripts for the next season, but if there's a writer's room concept, when it gets to those little ticks or motifs that he likes to explore, you know, if Sarah Dollard's also in the room, she might say, well, why don't we do this? And why don't we flip this around? And why don't we take that? And all of a sudden, Mark Gatiss' script becomes unpredictable again and becomes something that you kind of go, oh, that's happening, and I don't really usually expect that. So I think if that's his idea, that's not a bad idea. When it comes to his writing personally, I haven't really been hugely blown away by his previous stuff for the show, but I haven't also been hugely disappointed by it. So I'm optimistic, and I think if he's looking at bringing in changes like that, it could be a really exciting time for the show. It could be a new feel of it.
Okay. I always got to wonder to a
certain degree. It could also be terrible. Who knows?
you got to wonder to a certain degree when you're talking about any time where you're making some pretty pivotal changes. So now you've got a major casting direction in the nature of the casting. There's the potential that there might be a difference in the way that the writing structure and the production format is going to be approached. And if there are that and maybe even a half a dozen other things that get put into the mix along with an entirely new crew and on and on and on. Then from a critic's standpoint, they look at it and say, well, all right, well, if things are going extremely well or extremely poorly, you know, where do you point at, you know, that was the catalyst, that was the thing that did it, either dragged it down or lifted it up or what have you, because it's rather than having incremental changes along the way, you don't really have that kind of an opportunity when you're laying out the nature of an entire BBC series. Mm-hmm. you don't have that luxury. You can't say, well, we'll do this, you know, slight steering corrections along the way. Everything's got to get mapped out, at least within the production blocks, and then move on from there. So,
yeah, and I, you know, the one thing that does give me pause is if they do a lot of changes, then, you know, is the Colin Baker syndrome going to happen where Jodie Whittaker will get blamed for problems that aren't Jodie Whittaker's fault, right? Like I think Colin Baker's performance was always very good in the show. I think there were some production choices at the time that were very not good. To some degree, he certainly from the point of view of the BBC, he got the blame, right? And the idea was that if we, you know, get rid of him and put in a new actor, all those problems will be solved. And I don't think they were solved really until you got a new creative direction with Andrew Cartmell. So, that does give you pause, I think, when it feels this, you know, this much of a clean broom or new broom, I should say. But I just got to hope if he's anything like us and it's a fan, which he seems to be, then he hasn't just been thinking about this for a year. He's been thinking about it his whole life. So, you know, we'll see his vision, and as long as it's honest and true and still feels like Doctor Who, I don't see how it can't work, because at least it'll feel a little bit new, right? Or it'll be terrible.
So. Either way, our interest is completely locked in.
Yeah.
All right. Jay, do you think it's about news time?
Yeah, absolutely news.
All right. Where do we even want to start?
Well, let's start with the most exciting and most pressing news. The guys over at Riff Trax are going to be doing something absolutely spectacular. They will be taking on the 20th or the 10th anniversary special? Or
20th.
20th, sorry, yeah. 20th. I was there eventually. they will be doing the Five Doctors. So...
Yeah, not only doing their usual Riff Trax send up, but they will be as a result of a Fathom Events getting involved with it. This will be one of the ones where you can go and catch it in a cinematic experience. So go get your comfy seat, get your snacks, and proceed to have, you know, basically all the things that you were probably thinking but didn't dare actually express because you felt like you were somehow, like, you know, giggling in church or something by making fun of the Five Doctors. No, all bets are off. I'm really looking forward to this. I think the fact that they're doing this on two different nights, which is surprising. Don't they normally just do these as kind of a one and done sort of thing?
Usually, yeah.
I'm surprised.
I think that is it one going to be live and the other one is going to be a rebroadcast of the original live. I think they're doing it live for the first showing.
Maybe
simulcasting. I don't know.
Yeah, I've never caught one of these things that were supposedly supposed to be live, or even when they were live, it was actually by the time that it was actually broadcast stateside, it was usually a pre-recorded thing. Like,
yeah.
You know, when it was the, you know, Monty Python live, or it was the, you know, the what was the other one that we caught, the Shakespeare live with Tennant and Tate and everything, that was all obviously pre-recorded for the time shift. So this being a stateside production, I'd like to catch it live. I guess it'd be kind of cool. So what are our dates for this one? What do we have to start jumping on our calendars as of
like right now? As we record this, the first screening is actually going to be on August 17th, so this Thursday. If you manage to get to the show late and that's already passed, you've got another week. They will be doing it the following Thursday on the 24th.
Okay.
So August 17th and 24th are the dates.
Gotcha. All right.
And you just go to fathom.com? Is that what is that?
Fathomevents.com, I believe.
Fathom Events.
We'll make sure that we put all the link to the whole write-up in the news notes there. Because it's just one of those things where everybody has to know what everybody else thinks about Jodie Whittaker, they they finally got a chance to talk to our 10th Doctor and get his opinion on it. And he made a statement that I thought was a rather interesting choice of words. I don't have a problem with it. I just thought it was an interesting choice of words. And when I sort of dug into it further, it made a lot of sense to me personally, but I wanted to get everybody's opinion on it. The word irrelevant came up in his discussion, basically saying that once you see her in the role, it follows that cycle that we all love to talk about. It's the, It's that cycle of the new Doctor that we've seen the infographic go around. The who the heck is this guy? I hate this guy.
Yep.
Oh, wait, he's talking. Oh, my God, that's my Doctor. Where's my Doctor going? Who the heck's this guy? And yeah. cycle goes yeah. around and around, around. So I think that's kind of where he was headed with this.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that felt like it was kind of... Obviously, he knows her very well. They consider each other mates. They've worked on these productions before. They've known each other for a number of years now. And he's really eager and excited to see it all happen. But it just seemed like such a funny way of kind of phrasing his endorsement, so to speak.
Yeah, it seems like he could have chosen a better word than irrelevant. I mean, because you can't deny that this is a huge, huge change. That you know, it's pretty amazing that this happened. So to term it irrelevant, even though I understand where he's coming from with it, it just seems like he could have chosen a better word.
And we love semantics, so we get to pick all this stuff apart.
Yeah, we've got 2 years without episodes to fill. Of course, we're going to tear apart every word everyone uses.
Yeah. I mean,
dig into the minutia? No.
Yeah, I think he just, he might have picked a better word, but I also think, like, I kind of see what he means, too, right? You know, he's kind of saying, like,
oh, yeah.
At the end of the day, she's going to be your doctor, right? And everything else is just noise, you know? And I can see him, like, you know, what did he say? He said something like, who's this? When I got the part, everyone said, who's this weasel-faced guy? You know, I mean, which is, you know, and it's such a truth, right? It's just that everybody hates them until they grow and until they're the doctor. And then once they're the doctor, then everything and nothing else matters.
Yeah. Which in most of our experiences has been about a whopping episode.
Yeah.
So, So again, just hurry up and wait. Mm-hmm. But one thing that you will not have to wait quite so long for is the fact that we are not done with Missy. No, this time it's not Big Finish. Mm-hmm. It's just one of these rare occasions where somebody's beating Big Finish to the punch on something, probably because of licensing. But we're going to get a series of short stories that have been put together in these sort of these chronicles, the Chronicles of Missy. I love when these little book releases come out. I remember when they did the 11 stories for 11 doctors right around the 50th anniversary, and they had that little, you know, that compendium of short stories. I was hoping that they were going to do something similar where they were going to take authors of note and give them an opportunity to say, you know, where would you run with the character? What would you do? And so forth. I think this was a little bit more, I'm not really sure what the selection process was for the authors involved with this. But nonetheless, you get your pre-orders in now. UK will obviously get a hold of it a little early, but make sure that you acquire it through your local bookseller.
Yeah, and it's on Amazon right now for only, £10? Mm-hmm. So what is that in US dollars, like 17?
Like 15 cents.
It's going to be like 20.
It's like pounds. Two cubits. bag full of hazelnuts. I don't know, two chickens, whatever the trade exchange is these days. What is that in Australian dollars? It just the eyes would roll back. I'd have no way of doing that conversion whatsoever. Aren't they called loonies or something?
That's Canada, Hanson, okay?
Oh, sorry. I lose track of all these funny monies that don't have my dead presidents on them, except for Benjamin Franklin, that's who was true. Never a president.
Also, Alexander Hamilton, not a president.
Should have been.
He's never going to be president now.
Well, there's your ultimate time travel episode. Doctor diving in front of Burr's bullet. Not wow. yet.
Stronger central bank, yeah.
Well, last piece put in here, because we always got to end on a feel-good note. Go ahead and watch 45 seconds of Jodie Whittaker reacting to seeing cosplayers already representing the Third Doctor. Male and female cosplayers.
Yes.
Representing the 13th Doctor, and she's over the moon about it. And yeah. Again, it just goes back to saying, if they don't let her keep her accent, I'm going to be pissed.
I know. It's so great. What's the Planet 7 North?
Oh, yeah. My God. It's melodic. It's just, yeah. I want it so thick you need subtitles. I just, yeah. And when she gets mad, can you imagine the angry doctor speeches when she gets worked up?
Mm-hmm. Oh. And there will be so many nerds on the internet being like, no, this is what she said. And there's going to be huge arguments going on.
Were there apostrophes in that or some sort of strange punctuation marks? I don't... I've never heard consonants pronounced like that before.
I actually had a discussion with a friend of mine this week. She had asked me why David Tennant wasn't able to keep his original accent when he, and you know, I explained to her the story about how, you know, Eccleston had a regional accent, so they wanted to kind of steer away from that. And I'm like, okay, that's fine and dandy when the show is just coming back. I mean, it was only on for a series at that point, so I can understand that, but come on, the show is a global commodity now. I think we can handle a regional accent after having a Scottish doctor. So Here's hoping that they manage to keep that in there.
I think viewer ears start to condition after a while.
Oh yeah,
A lot of people were complaining about Capaldi that they couldn't understand him, especially when he got really worked up within the first couple of episodes. They complained about Bill.
Mm-hmm.
That they couldn't understand Pearl Mackey's accent because it was too American viewers. I'll just take a stateside, particularly, obviously.
Yeah.
But it was just a matter of, you know, especially because she has a very fast speaking meter. Mm-hmm. So, but those things sort of fell to the wayside after a little while. Either they turned closed captions on or what they did. Or maybe they just felt they had to watch the episode a couple times, which no problem with that either. But no, I mean, I'd love this because there were times watching Broadchurch where, based on the emotional investment that she had in particular scenes, the accent would thicken or back off a little bit. And I always loved it when she was at full tear. And then when they started interviewing her after the casting as the 13th Doctor, and she's just speaking off the cuff, and she's getting really excited about it, she's really chuffed about everything that's happening, and her accent's at full bore. I'm like, oh, this is going to make for fantastic television. This is, it's at the same time that it's reaching out to this wildly vaster audience, or as far as cultivating a new audience, at the same time, it's still saying so inherently British right now. This is just
very true.
So, yeah, can't wait. Can't wait.
While we're on the topic of accents, and particularly David Tennant's accent, just because we brought it up before, I kind of wanted to talk about it. DuckTales just aired its first episode recently.
Oh, okay. All right. And we've been waiting for this.
It is absolutely spectacular. Like, I was watching it, I felt like I was 9 years old again. It was brilliant.
It's great.
The first couple minutes, I'm like, holy crap, yep, nope, that's David Tennant. That is his Scottish accent right there. By the end of the first episode, I'm just going to like, no, that's Scrooge McDuck. Screw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he dive in the money pit?
He did. That was kind of like the culmination of the first episode was him learning to swim in the money.
Fantastic. That's great.
I want to see the outtakes of him just clonking into the top of the coins, just beating himself repeatedly. Oh, I got to point the fingers. Point the fingers to dive in. Okay.
Just like an explosion of feathers as he hits the money super hard. Smack! Pow! You know.
And then hearing David Tennant go full Capaldi and just start swearing up a storm.
Cursing up, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be good.
All right. Well, Jeremy, we want to make sure that people have an opportunity. You did mention that your day job right now is obviously talking about those kooky comic books and all those things that they have to say as they're rotting the minds of our children and adults.
It's true. It's true.
How can people go about this?
Well, I write for a website called capelesscrusader.org, the website is, comics news and reviews, but we provide a little more than that. We like to say we do comics in context, so it's not just about, news in the industry or reviewing the actual product from that point of view, but also about presenting it within a social construct and how it interacts with the society around us. So, for instance, just something that's topical, right before the unfortunate events happening in Charlottesville, I wrote a piece about a real-life gentleman who's part of the alt-right and a white nationalist, and he's trying to get a comic book made of his exploits called Based Stick Man. And many of the figures that you see who were rioting in Charlottesville brutally this weekend, they kind of draw their look with the wooden shields and the sticks from this man. So, you know, we get to write pieces like that explore sort of how comics intersects with everybody's everyday life and what that means. And so I hope that hopefully that's what we offer. That's a little bit different than your average, you know, news and reviews site. But we still do all that stuff, and we still do funny articles and funny pieces. And so I'm a staff writer there, and I write features and reviews, and that's basically what I'm working on right now. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, and I do lots of Doctor Who reviews as well, head on over to capelesscrusader.org, and hopefully you'll find some things there that'll tickle your fancy, as it were.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And Jay, what have we got coming up next week when we three meet again?
Well, we were going to try and talk about this before, and then, you know, some crazy news story came up that
some Wimbledon thing.
we want to take a look back at the Moffat era as a whole, with him bowing out after the Christmas special coming up. We want to take a look back at what his contribution to Doctor Who as a whole was, and what we gained and things that can be improved upon moving forward and that kind of thing. So really looking forward to this discussion.
Yeah, kind of a culmination of ways that we've talked about his work in episodes past. You know, we've talked about his take on death of characters. We've talked about his take on doctor companion relationships, or the balance between emotion and sort of cold science fiction and so forth. And then obviously just the discussion about the kind of attacks that he's come under, both on social media and then just from the critics at large about the things that he's done to sort of move the show forward, and how successful or unsuccessful people have felt that he's been. Many people still saying, okay, now thank goodness that's over. Now we can get back to you know, make Doctor Who great again, or whatever they're going to discuss about. But again, we're going to sort of call that all together, but at the same time, sort of look and see where does that leave us standing as far as opportunities for evolution moving forward. So really looking forward to that discussion. And we're going to pick everybody's brain. So listeners, please, if you've got some thoughts on it, we're giving you an early kind of glance into this so that you can start sharing your thoughts with us for inclusion in our next week's program.
Yes. All right. Well, this has been episode 246 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, yes, well, never mind the mumbo jumbo. Keep the wretched thing switched off until it's ready.
And this is Kier saying, I only need two things, your submission and your obedience to my will.
And this is Haley saying, the greater good.
The greater good.
All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Panel Z.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Just finishing up the episode, so.
Oh my god! you're fired, Mally. Jesus.
In my defense, I had to rebuild my desk and computer before I could start watching it. Done. Okay.
All right. I'll give you a hint. The master gets thwarted. Benton gets hit on by the White Witch, and Bessie drives around in circles while they all do the Maypole dance.
Yeah, Morris dancing. Thank God that made its way into Doctor Who.
Okay. Oh, she's reading. Hold on. I got to give her a minute. Yeah. Nobody talk because it's going to throw her off while she's reading. Guys, stop.
Is everybody recording?
Yeah. We discussed that while you were finishing the episode.
Okay, that's good.